Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. The front pages are pretty much all on the same track. As you may have heard, the Supreme Leader obviously is dead. The Sunday Times, Ayatollah killed in blitz from America and Israel. The Sunday Independent, chaos spreads in Middle East as Iran retaliates to US airstrikes. The Sun on Sunday, Ayatollah dead, Tehran blitzed by Trump. Khamenei's palace hit, President, he was killed. That, I think they mean Donald Trump saying it. The Israelis were saying it first. The Iranians denying it until they couldn't deny it anymore. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Ayatollah Khamenei taken out by 30 bombs. The Mirror, Middle East in flames. And the Business Post then has a different highly unsettling headline. Boomtime, corporation tax set to soar to record 36 billion. They actually have a piece inside based on this. And the headline is, this will rattle you. The headline is, a never-ending miracle, how Ireland's boom faced down global chaos. So if that doesn't make you nervous, I don't know what will. But in fairness, Seamus Coffey, who people view as, you know, he's a bit of an ER on these things, the chairman of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, said he expected the new tax rate, so the tax rate's going up from 12.5 to 15%, will add 5 billion to the state coffers. He says, over the next 5 years, we could potentially see corporation tax receipts halve to 15 billion, or we could see them grow to 45 billion. Which do I think is more likely? It's probably 45 billion, but there's no hard or fast rule on that. So there you go. Our panel this morning, Brenda Power is a columnist with the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Independent newspapers. Alan Barrett is a research professor at the ESRI. Liz Carlin is publisher at thebriefing.ie. And Pat Leahy is political editor of the Irish Times. And good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Brenda, I suspect you would have been one of those people who thought that the left and a lot of people didn't care as much about the people of Iran as they do about other causes and everything. And I suspect that you were glad to see them dancing in the streets last night. But it's a bit more complicated than that, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. But yeah, I don't think anybody with a brain in their head will be weeping for Khamenei's death. And you're quite right. There was a marked absence, actually, of protests in support here of the Iranian people. Went up to, at the last estimate I saw, 40,000 of them might have been slaughtered by their own government when they tried to oppose. And among their chants were death to Khamenei. So apparently there are chanting and celebrations in the street this morning. Of course, the question is what's going to replace him.
Yeah.
The difference is, I suppose, in this situation, there is widespread support in Iran for the ending of this regime. And that's maybe different to previous situations where there has been attempts to change.
Alan, your top line thoughts on the situation we find ourselves in today?
Well, when I woke up yesterday morning, the reporting on the news was partly about Donald Trump talking about imminent threats, and it was impossible not to have a flashback to George W. Bush, all again talking about imminent threats. At the time, of course, George W. Bush was aligned with Tony Blair, and Blair is back in the news. Partly there's the Channel 4 documentary about him, so we're all thinking about him again, but now it seems to be Trump and Netanyahu are the co-actors here.
Yeah.
And completely accepting the point that this is an appalling regime, it's very difficult to be sort of trusting of the motivations behind this invasion. Just a very quick point. There's very little about Epstein in the papers today.
Yeah.
And you just wonder if something similar happened in the United States.
We don't want to be conspiracy theorists, right? But I felt that watching CNN on Friday night, as the Epstein thing got closer and closer to Trump, as the Democrats came out and spoke at that during a break in the Clinton hearing, and as the drumbeat started growing about a new precedent has been set, a president can come in front of a Congress committee, that the war was also being ramped up almost in real time. But look, that exactly. is conspiracy
well,
theory.
Well, it's not no, but yeah. conspiracy theories can be right on occasions, Brendan. Yeah, and the other thing occasion. Is, but let's also remember too, Netanyahu faces elections. There's a theory that he kept the war going in Gaza for as long as he did, essentially to keep himself out of prison. You know, Gaza is not settled, but you know it is eased. So that between the two of them, it's very difficult not to look at it cynically.
The best case scenario here is a 15 to 20 year, very, very difficult economic, political and social transition, right? Do we believe that the motivation, the intent, the commitment of the Netanyahu-Trump alliance to that process is there? Can the people of Iran trust that if they do, as he says, you know, rise up and to, you know, how 93 million people, quote, take over your government? Has anybody thought that through? Does anybody know what that looks like? It does really feel like deja vu. But, you know, in the run up to the Iraq war, there was all of that debate. There was all of that discussion. Yes, they rammed it through anyway.
But Bush traveled the country talking to people about it and explaining.
And the UN,
this,
and
it
he
was
got
a very different scenario.
He built his, you know, he got allies and everything else, and it was still an absolute disaster, and he still didn't escape the repercussions and the
political
fallout.
There's never been a successful regime change from outside, essentially, has there? Which is maybe why Trump is trying to portray this one differently, that we've taken the head off and now it's people.
There were successful interventions in the 90s, but they were very, very different. Like, you know, Sierra Leone or Kosovo, things like that, very small scale. And, you know, and again, in those scenarios, you know, Sierra Leone has a life expectancy of 55, right? Like, the Kosovo is still a bit of a basket case, being very frank politically. These are incredibly long-term processes. It's not the kind of thing that, frankly, I think we can trust this regime has thought through properly.
We'll get into more of it afterwards. I'm going to bring in Scott Lucas in a minute just to give us a bit of, but I just want to get top-line thoughts first. Pat, what do you think is important right now?
Well, the question is, what happens next? There's no question but that the United States and Israel together can devastate Iran militarily. They've already decapitated the leadership. But whether there is any serious thought gone into what happens after the regime is taken out.
Reza Pahlavi is going to tell people what time to leave their houses and go out on the street. He has told them this, like, I will tell you at the time and you can go out and do it then. That's his plan anyway.
Well, it's always the question in politics, isn't it? People talk about change, but change to what? Mm-hmm. And is the what necessarily better for people than what went behind, went before?
Well, let's drill into that a bit now with Professor Scott Lucas, Professor of Politics and International Relations from UCD. Am I right in your title there, Scott?
Sounds good to me, Brendan.
Okay, so look, Scott, first, how do you see the conflict playing out in the coming days and weeks? Trump seems to have said that the bombing is going to go on for, he said, during the week anyway, suggesting to me that there's a week more in this of precision, he said, and intense bombing.
I think, as always, Brendan, it's best to set Trump's latest tweets aside and focus on others in the U.S. administration in Israel to say that we are in the midst of ongoing attacks. Indeed, Israel this morning has hit Tehran especially hard with attacks on at least 7 different locations. And I think you can expect that because even though the Supreme Leader is gone, and indeed several other key officials were killed yesterday, the Defense Secretary, the head of the Revolutionary Guards, the Army Chief of Staff among them, there are many other top officials who are still there, political and military. And until you get a sign from the regime that it's willing to accept what are effectively the American ultimatum that was handed down a few days ago, which is you give up your nuclear program permanently, absolutely no uranium enrichment, and you limit your ballistic missiles. Until you get that sign, I think the Americans continue, and I think, of course, the Israelis continue, because the Netanyahu government does want regime change. They don't just want regime accommodation where the Supreme Leader is gone and then others remain in place.
Okay, so could this be where, so we go to what happens next in Iran. Could this be where Trump sells out his good buddy Netanyahu? Like, if someone like, I see Larijani, the security chief, who apparently the Supreme Leader had basically handed over control of the country to in January anyway. I see him being mentioned as an ideologue, but a pragmatic ideologue, who might be willing to do business with the US. So if a version of the current regime turns around and says to the US, we'll do business with you, is Trump just going to go, that's fine, so?
I think if Trump's advisors, and I think you've got several you could look at. I think you look at Marco Rubio, Secretary of State. I think you look at J.D. Vance, the vice president. I think you look at other senior political officials in the National Security Council. And if they go to Trump and say, look, the Iranian leadership is going to scrap nuclear enrichment entirely. That's it. Gone.
Okay.
Which, of course, the Iran... and I think then, yeah...
Trump won't care about regime change then, all of a sudden, will he?
No, I think Trump will care about a couple of things. One is Trump will want to be able to declare some type of victory, right? And he can do that without completely toppling the regime. And secondly, of course, he'll want to declare that there are economic benefits out of this. So he's going to want to declare, for example, that Iran's going to start selling its oil to the United States.
Okay. So where is the look at some of the broader coalitions here. Trump's administration, the MAGA movement, where are they on all this? Because this is not what the MAGA people signed up for, is it?
No, and you saw some MAGA people come out, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, just in strident messages yesterday saying what the hell's going on. But I think despite the fact that there's a complete contradiction here, that 9 days after declaring himself the president of the Board of Peace, Donald Trump is waging war, nothing succeeds like success. And if he and his camp can sell the idea of we've killed the ultimate villain, the supreme leader, this is what American power can do. And if you can curb this fairly quickly, where there isn't ongoing disorder in Iran, where the country doesn't fall into chaos, in effect, where it doesn't become a repeat of Iraq 2003, then I think he gets away with this, especially if you don't have to put any American troops on the ground.
Okay, and he gets away with it with the broader American public just about as well, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. Although I've got to say, Brendan, I think the key issues this year are not going to be Iran and it's not going to be foreign policy. We'll be talking about the economy and about Epstein within the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. Okay. Scott, stay with us. Alan, you did pick a piece in the Sunday Times, Katie Balls, and the word gamble is being used a lot here. Katie Balls' piece is how Trump's biggest bet yet could define his presidency. And as Scott was saying there, a lot of this depends on how it turns out, doesn't it? But like, there's a wide potential array of options here, isn't there?
There is. I mean, Scott has set them out. As you say, this does seem completely contradictory with the sort of things he was saying previously about his desire not to get involved in wars of this nature. He seemed to be very critical of what used to be the sort of the neocons or the nation builders in previous administrations. But again, the way sort of Scott has put it, like the paper in Sunday Times gave talked about this big bet, but I mean, you know, maybe he can control it to a greater degree if he's disciplined enough, in a sense that having sort of taken out the supreme leader, if he can sort of surgically do the range of things, that maybe he can come back. I mean, betting is all about, you know, can you control some of the uncertainties. The one remaining thing that Scott didn't touch on, though, that I still wonder about is the Israeli dimension in this, and it seems that Netanyahu has sort of created the sense of Iran being, as he calls it, this existential threat.
And then there is a Nazi question. Regime of the modern era.
Exactly.
Is what
I mean, the question is: does he expect a greater degree of destruction and annihilation and everything like that? And is that really where he is at? And then the question is about the dynamic between himself and Trump, and what precisely is going on there. The New York Times summed it up quite well yesterday. I mean, they basically said Trump only cares, they thought, about three things, which are tariffs, Greenland, and building the wall. Okay, that he doesn't actually have huge amounts of fundamental beliefs or anything like that, and that he can be swayed on an ongoing basis. So the New York Times article yesterday, I mean, their view was that essentially it was the Netanyahu government had managed to sway him in a particular direction, and it's still this ongoing question then about, well, precisely what matters, and that ongoing need, as we talked about earlier, to keep the Epstein issue out of the newspapers.
Pat, there's a lot of really good obituaries. We've been talking a lot about the Supreme Leader for the last few days, but tell us a little bit about him, because it's a fascinating kind of story, isn't it?
Yeah, what I only realised reading some of the obituaries this morning, is a very complete one in the New York Times, is that despite being the chief Ayatollah and supreme leader, that he actually wasn't a cleric. He was made an Ayatollah in order so he could take over this role when his predecessor, the Ayatollah Khamenei, died in 1989. So he was actually, he was a secular figure. He had previously been president, and he has ruled.
He used to smoke cigarettes and a pipe and read Western novels like Victor Hugo and Sartre and all this kind of thing. He was a student-y kind of figure in a way.
Up to a point, Brett. Yeah. Student-y figure who went on to be, a brutal repressor of his own.
Which seems to
people.
Have happened gradually then, didn't it? Like, once he got in power, he became more and more oppressive as time went on.
He did, yeah. So he had this kind of twin approach which has shaped Iran. And he, more than, the Ayatollah Khomeini who led the revolution or was the figure in power after the revolution, is kind of the architect of the Iran that we know today. And that's marked by this aggressive foreign policy, particularly against the US and Israel, exporting Iranian influence throughout the region through associated militias. And then anytime there is a whiff of dissent at home, that is brutally clamped down on, with thousands and thousands of people killed over the years, most recently in following the uprising there earlier this year. So that is very much his creation. And now he is gone, and he had named three potential successors during the previous attacks on Iran. How many of those are still around, or will be still around, when this, the kinetic phase of this
there's been a suggestion for a while that the Revolutionary Guard would use his death, which was coming anyway, as some kind of excuse to pivot the way the country was run anyway. Brenda, you picked the Mark Urban piece. The key question now is, will Iranian people turn on the regime? So this question of, like, is Trump going to blow a whistle and tell people, OK, safe to come out of your homes, take over now? Is it really realistic? I heard a lot of people say that you definitely can't do that from the air, that you need to send in ground troops to support an uprising if it's to work.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, what will victory look like in this situation? Yeah. If you go in there and simply remove Khamenei and his cohorts, is that leadership, or, and then leave, is that negligence? Because you really do need to have a plan. Going in with the kinetic phase, as Pat put it, and then just leaving and saying over to you now is clearly not the answer. On the other hand,
some people saying it's a recipe for a civil war, basically.
Yeah, because this is not a homogenous population. You have Kurds, you have Persians, you have Arabs. They don't even speak the same language. So, to say, come on, Iranian people, get together and replace him. On the other hand, regime change was never going to happen internally. It never was. And the Iranian regime was the biggest destabilizing force, certainly in the region, through its proxies, the Houthis, the Hamas, Hezbollah. So, it is in the interests of global peace, I would say, that this regime is replaced. The question is I think it's Raza Pahlavi. He's in Maryland, apparently, and he's saying, come out now on the streets, people.
Yeah, someone I was speaking to yesterday said the guy's basically a social media influencer. I did see the Irish Iranians yesterday out holding up, posters of him and his name, and certainly for the diaspora. He seems to be a popular figure.
Liz, what
do you reckon in terms of an uprising or whatever?
So there's two good quotes, I think, from stuff I was reading there this morning and overnight. So Phillips O'Brien, he's the kind of the military strategist, he's very into air power and sea power. He's like, air power can devastate a regime, it can't replace it. And The Atlantic is a really good piece by Karim Sajapour, and his kind of the crux of his point is, transitions are not populist contests, or are not popularity contests. They're about who can muster enough force to seize power when the vacuum arrives. Mm-hmm. And that's the stage that we're heading into.
to now is this vacuum. And, you know, if you listen to that 8 minutes yesterday in Mar-a-Lago with his cap on of Trump speaking, I mean, you know,
cap to show the gravity of the situation.
The gravity,
red,
yeah,
would have been too informal for a moment.
Exactly,
like
he wore his formal
baseball
cap. The Pope
has different vestments. Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, like we know that we take him seriously, not literally, whatever. But like he says, he does tend to say what he means. And he's like, people of Iran, when we are finished, take over your government. It will be yours to take. He is.
And also, this will be your last chance.
This will be your last
generation.
Chance. Next line. No president was willing to do what I'm willing to do tonight. This is about him. This is about his ego. I did this. And then he says, let's see how you respond. So he is putting the blame for what happens next, for the mess to come on Iran. In a month, in a couple of weeks, we don't know how long, he will get bored, he will move on. All of the blame will be put on the Iranian people. The, you know, like this morning, was there like 7 people shot dead outside of US Embassy in Pakistan? They're bombing, or there's attacks happening on ships in the Strait of Hormuz already. There's people coming out of Dubai saying things are being attacked. This is setting off a monumental cascade of a conflict, which is going to last a very, very long time. And he's already sowing the seeds of, well, I did my bit. I'm the greatest president in the world.
Okay.
No one's
okay.
dared to do this before.
So, Scott, can I come back to you again? And we talk vaguely about what might happen next. But now, having heard all that, and in terms of the idea of the people rising up and everything, what do you, if you were a betting man, what does the next phase of this regime look like to you?
Let me just set out the challenges, Brendan, that are there. The challenges of just simply parachuting in someone like Reza Pahlavi, who hasn't been in the country for decades, is while he may have support amongst many in the diaspora, and he may have support, you know, amongst some in Iran. And I say this, you know, with a lot of friends in Iran, having worked there, having taught there, the most people in Iran don't want to see Pahlavi come back, and they don't want to see the U.S. and Israel impose someone. Iran has been there before with coups. They don't want to go back there. Therefore, they want to see something come from within, but your panel have noted the barriers to that. I think if there is a way forward that I'm hoping for, it would be that you get pragmatists that come forward. Think about not just Larijani, but think about the former president, Hassan Rouhani, who was a centrist, who negotiated the nuclear deal with the West in 2015. If you get those people who are willing to talk to members of the opposition, because the opposition's leadership have been banged away for almost more than 15 years. If you get those pragmatists who are not only willing to discuss with others reforms, but they're also willing to release the political prisoners, and that includes the man who probably won the 2009 election, who's been under house arrest for 15 years, Mir Hossein Mousavi, if you get that, there may be a glimmer of hope going forward.
Okay, so that what we see, apparently it's much easier for a regime to shape-shift a little bit and stay in power than it is to overthrow a regime. And then, of course, Scott, we know that one of the big disasters of Iraq was this notion of debathification, that you had to cleanse all levels of society, but then you're left with nothing, no civil service or anything. So you would be hopeful that you could keep in place the institutions that run Iran, but with a different kind of leadership and a different kind of emphasis.
You have to keep the institutions there, or you get the vacuum that leads to civil war and insurgency.
Okay.
But you need to move away from a theocratic leadership. You need to move away from a supreme leader.
Okay, Scott Lucas, thank you very much for your insights this morning. Appreciate you taking the call. Alan Barrett, so we've heard about that, the Strait of Hormuz, like it's kind of mixed reports on whether it's been closed or not. The Iranians were apparently sending radio messages to ships saying it's closed, don't come through. We hear now that a small tanker was bombed off Oman. Tell us a bit about the, are we looking at an oil crisis? Are we looking at huge economic effects for the world as this goes on?
Well, let's see. But in terms of, again, the history and looking back, I mean, the Iranian, of course, revolution in 1979 generated an oil crisis and a global recession and everything like that. So historians of sort of economic matters will be quite tuned into this. Iran today is not as big a producer, relatively speaking, of oil. I mean, when these things happen, you become an expert overnight on all the dimensions of it. So I can now quote the figure that Iran, it produces 3% of global output.
So it's not a huge amount in and of itself, and it's, so that makes it quite different from 46 years ago. But you correctly say the concern here is not about Iran's output itself; it's whether or not it squeezes the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz. Now, the other thing to say here is they don't even need to be bombing things. All they need to do is have credible threats whereby ships are not going to sail. And it's not even the shipping companies you have to convince here. It's the insurance companies.
Okay.
So the Financial Times were reporting already yesterday that on Saturday, yesterday morning, the insurance companies that insure the tankers were already cancelling the policies and renegotiating new ones for Monday morning at significantly increased prices.
Okay.
So you can imagine the situation.
So market forces could do the job.
It just means, and I mean something like 20.
If this is beyond both of our field of expertise now, you just tell me. But do I get the feeling though that to close the Strait of Hormuz would be economically cutting off their nose, not that the economy is operating properly right now, would be cutting off their noses to spite their faces for the Iranians and would also annoy the Chinese?
Yes would be the answer to all of those sort of things. But you can imagine a regime that is in a particularly desperate situation.
Okay, they're not thinking
those sort of matters.
About Q4.
Exactly. But also the effects on others, such as Iraq and Saudi, would probably something, because it is 20% of global output actually goes through there. So, you know, it would be a bigger relative hit on those. So it is it's a huge concern. I always feel sort of slightly embarrassed about talking about economic matters when bombs are dropping on human beings. But I think, you know, the Ukraine war reminded us that you can be a long way from the conflict, but the economic spillover can be such that while some of the inflation we observe since, some of that was a sort of a post-COVID issue, but the spikes in energy prices led to the sort of inflation, the cost of living crisis, and sort of persisted. So these are things we do need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, Brenda, to what Alan was saying there, and let us not forget that there are people all over the Middle East in desperate situations now. Now, two pieces you picked. One is in the Sunday Times, Iranians living in Ireland fear for the safety of loved ones at home. And then in the Irish Mail on Sunday, Natalie Lisbona, who is writing from Israel.
Yes, right. She's in Israel. And she said, at this point, you are so used to the sirens going off, you barely hear them. So there was no sense of alarm on Saturday morning when you know, the usual alarms were sounded. But she's making the point that, you know, all of this, and I saw Catherine Connolly calling for, you know, renewed diplomatic efforts, that it is in the DNA of Iran to wreck deals. And, you know, that really people talking about we could have resolved this through dialogue it's magical thinking. There's an interesting piece too in the Mail by, I think it's Tobias Elwood, and he's making the point that, you know, we're talking about what will replace them. Don't, you know, rule out the Revolutionary Guard, because they are not just a military force, they're an embedded power structure right across all areas of Iranian life. And you could be replacing a theocrat with
a mafia with
a military despotism that could prove to be worse.
Yeah, Liz, you're nodding along there. Is that kind of, at the moment, looks like a likely scenario, does it, that the Revolutionary Guard just take control of the country in some shape or form?
Well, actually, the last time Pat, myself and Scott were in this studio was the day after Maduro was seized in Venezuela. And we were kind of talking about, well, what happens there with the vacuum? Nothing really happened there. The deputy stepped in and the US have just basically got a whole lot of leverage over that regime.
Yeah, so, and Trump takes a win and moves on.
That's
another war solved
This does feel different. I mean, the ripples out to so many countries in the region. And it's interesting looking at, you know, all, across all media, like there's a big weighting towards places where, you know, media have correspondence.
Yeah.
So we're hearing a lot out of Israel, you know, we're hearing kind of stories of things from Dubai. The ripples are going much further than that. So I can't see this being some sort of
one and done or anything. This
Absolutely
is
not.
Weeks, months,
years.
Yeah. The question being asked this morning on Twitter, how Ireland should respond formally to the death of the Supreme Leader. If the Iranian embassy opens a book of condolence, will the Taoiseach or the President visit the embassy to sign it? Pat, what do you reckon?
I very much doubt it. To be honest. I mean, I can imagine that would not be the question that Micheál Martin would want to take.
I when feel he it would almost be an ecumenical,
in a few weeks' time.
It would be an ecumenical matter, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Our panel staying with us. We'll move closer to home after the break. Brenda Power, Alan Barr, Liz Carlin, and Pat Leahy. Welcome back. Our terrific panel still with us. Brenda Power, Alan Barr, Liz Carlin, and Pat Leahy. Alan Barrett, the boom is getting boomier. Corporation tax take set to soar to a record 36 billion is the front page of the Business Post, and the never-ending miracle.
I have to say, like, I really gasped when I read those headlines.
It's probably true, though, isn't it? Do most economists not agree it is probably true for now?
What's probably true?
That corporation tax is going to keep going up in the immediate.
I think that's probably true. But around 2004, 2005, it was also probably true that property-related taxes were going to keep flowing in. Look, just to step back for a little bit, I think it's sort of well understood that corporation tax has grown enormously in Ireland. One of the figures in the paper this morning, I mean, about a decade ago, we took in about 3 billion in corporation tax. Now we're taking in 34 billion. I mean, if anybody looks at those figures, I think anybody would have to consider, like, we're not doing anything in Ireland, okay, that underpins that sort of an increase. Most of this growth...
Apart from the fact that Matt Cooper has a really well-researched piece on the back of the Business Post with the big three who pay half that tax, which is Apple, Microsoft and Eli Lilly, and their operations here and how embedded they are in the country. And he flags a few, you know, kind of rumbles of thunder in the distance, but he is saying that they are here and they are doing real things.
Absolutely they are, but there's no guarantee they're going to be here forever. Okay, and it's a remarkably narrow base on which to sort of, you know, to have the foundation of fiscal policy around it. So nobody has ever sort of said that this is likely to vanish, you know, in a few years' time. But the parallel is, if you take a country like Norway, I mean, they're going to have oil and gas for quite a while as well. Yeah. But they've made the sort of the decision where we're not necessarily going to have this forever.
So we need to be saving more of this, which is not popular with people, or do we need to keep spending more on everything that turns up?
No, we need to be putting the government is setting a proportion of this aside, okay, but I think again the Fiscal Council talked about this recently. They're putting about one in 8 euro aside of what the Department of Finance themselves refer to as the windfall dimension of this, okay. So about the Department of Finance cannot explain related to Irish fundamentals where a substantial proportion of this tax is actually coming from. Most of it over the last number of years has to do with sort of changes in tax regimes and in
IP
international tax and all those sort of things. And when you hear something like, you know, IP flowed into the country, IP can flow out of the country. So it's a phenomenally risky strategy. I think people like my colleagues and myself in the SRI, the Fiscal Council, I think a lot of people have been talking about this and trying to just emphasise that, yes, it's great that the money is there, but a more sound and rational approach to this would be to be putting it away for things like population ageing and a whole range of things that are going to be coming down the line. But can I just say that the scary, in spite of even the war in Iran, and I shouldn't trivialise it, there is a sentence in the Business Post article which sort of suggests that the conservative civil servants of the Department of Finance have been trying to, you know, obscure all this largesse. But there's the phrase that the leaders are now copping on. It's almost like that the political heads are now sort of saying that, oh, maybe this will go on forever and maybe we can spend more and more and more of it. And I have to say that's a really troubling development, because it may well go on.
Yeah, but there's a
fragility.
If the civil servants have kept saying this is going to start going down or this is going to fall off a cliff and it keeps not happening, it probably does feed a kind of a boy who cried wolf kind of mentality, doesn't it?
It does, but I mean, you know, even in this optimistic sort of piece, and like never ending miracle just gives me palpitations having as a headline about
our economy. Well, we have a trauma around, like, around optimism.
We do, but like if you're 5 years from retirement, right, and somebody says to you, well, your pension could be worth 150 grand or half a million grand, right, or half a million euro in 5 years' time. That's what this is saying. We could have 15 billion or we could have 45 billion.
Yeah.
That level of uncertainty is just absolutely absurd. And like, I think that the optimism has an impact if it means that we're doubling down on the FDI, on basically the IDA versus Enterprise Ireland. If we're kind of saying, listen, this is all that we need to do. We'll keep investing in our little startups so that they can be bought out by these big tech companies. But ultimately, you know, we're an FDI driven economy. We're not building that insurance. We're not getting maybe like a second more secure pension, right? Yeah. Like a safer. We're not doing some of these kind of safer investments to make sure that, like, you know, we're not exposing ourselves. And even if the risk is 5% of this thing collapsing, when the risk is something existential, right? Yeah. A 5% risk is something you have to take extremely seriously.
But then, Pat, you talk about the government ever got re-elected on saving money, did they?
Well, that's true. And there are political realities here as well. But people often talk about this in the context of the warnings of it. And people say, oh, you know, they're the boy who cried wolf. The whole point of the story of the boy who cried wolf is that the wolf turns up in the end, you know, and people tend to lose sight of that. And, you know, those figures in the Business Post are, you know, amazing, 36 billion expected this year. It doesn't have to be a collapse of that to radically transform the budget making scenario for the government. If this government had 10 billion euros less, which would bring us back to where we were 3 or 4 years ago, that would give you a much, much different budget to the ones we have become used to. And therefore, our politics looks an awful lot different.
And what does budget making scenario means? That means how much social welfare payments are. This means what pension payments are. It means how many houses we can do. It means how many SNAs are in schools.
Yes.
The impacts are very real.
We shouldn't lose sight of the public demand for that. And the public demand for that is not because everybody wants to go party. It's because they perceive that there are shortcomings in public services, in health and education. We saw the row about the SNAs during the week. And politicians feel a pressure from underneath, as it were, to spend the money to obtain those improvements in
Alan,
public
services. Alan, you picked an interesting piece on that in the Sunday Times. Hildegard Nocton's radar was off on funds for special needs, in the sense that what happened there was kind of strange in that there were no cutbacks of special needs assistance. Right, they were being redeployed and everything. But the net result of it was that now there will be more special needs assistance.
Yeah, it was a fascinating story all in all. And again, if I think myself and my colleagues in the SRI, like, we sort of sit around thinking, well, we're really good at economics, but even Pat made reference to it, but, you know, but there's all the politics there and we're not as good as the politics. And sometimes we suggest
you
things.
Don't have to get re-elected.
And yeah, but from time to time, it's funny, you look at the politicians and you wonder, well, they don't seem to be very good at the politics either. Because I would have thought anybody could have sort of said that if you essentially, you know, send out a memo which says you might or might not lose your SNA. And again, everybody understands that the loss of something that you have has much bigger impact on you than the getting of something that you don't have. So this was a very, very sort of strange development all in all. But the extent to which the solution is always ultimately we will find an extra 20 million somewhere to deal with the, you know, with the issue that we've created. It goes to that sort of issue that when there is so much money flowing in, it doesn't actually always mean that the money is brilliantly spent. I mean, in many ways, when you have tighter budgets, very, very often there's more thought given to how precisely are we going to spend this money. And if you're in that sort of situation of just sort of, you know, snuff of the wedding or whatever like that, it rarely leads to sort of rational or good decision making.
You know, Brenda. I was just going to say, I was going to mention the Norwegian example as well, because once oil revenues improved after the sanctions on Russia, they set up a kind of a public savings fund and said, look, we are not going to have this money coming in forever. That message doesn't seem to be getting through here. And it's more of a kind of Charlie McCreevy, when I have it, I'll spend it type of expectation by the public that this money. But I mean, I do find those, well, like Liz said,
we
those
do have
scary.
A
yeah,
savings
sorry,
fund.
Just for, no, but, what were we going to say?
No,
you
but
do
just,
find?
Just to agree with this, I think it's terrifying to think that so much of our economic reality is based in future, is based on three companies.
And you can quantify oil. You can watch the oil numbers go down and you can plan and you can do projections and you can sell as much as you want. Figuring out how global capital is going to respond in a very uncertain world. And I think that point about, you know, Eli Lilly, Apple, they are very different than, say, Meta or Google or sort of other companies. And I think we're seeing a bit of a change in government attitude hardening to some of those more flexible capital, you know, like the government's attitude towards social media companies, like that seems to be going in one direction.
Mm. Can I just say, the mention, Brenda mentions Charlie McCreevy, okay, and we always talk about him in the When I Have It, I Spend It. Even Charlie McCreevy set up the National Pension Reserve Fund. I mean, when you think about it, he was the Minister of Finance when we sold Telecom Éireann. Mm. He took all the money and put it into the fund and then committed to putting 1% of GDP into the fund thereafter. Now, that's about 25 years ago. Had that fund been in place, you know, we could now look a little bit more enthusiastically on our ageing population. Of course, all that money then went during the financial crisis. Yeah. But as I said, even the guy who has all that bad reputation about spending and everything like that, even he managed to put a substantial chunk of money aside.
Okay, we should be fair that there is a sort of a sovereign wealth fund in existence,
and an infrastructure and climate
running,
fund as well,
you know,
which
very
we
substantial
are.
Surpluses. So when you say to people,
I can't let that go, Brendan. I'm really sorry, and I don't mean to interrupt. We are running a substantial surplus, okay? But when you take away the wind, not even all the corporation tax, just the windfall dimension, we have a deficit that's about
100%. 100%. No, I don't dispute really that for important. A minute. The argument is not whether we should set up a windfall, a sovereign wealth fund, or whether we should run smaller surpluses. The argument is the proportion in which we do it. Yeah. And I think an awful lot of people would think that saving only 1 in 7 or 1 in 8 of the euros that are generated by windfall profits is far too small.
Fair enough. Yeah, okay. There's a poll in the Sunday Independent. Liz, I know you want to talk about it, but just Pat first, as a political editor, what jumped out at you here?
Not a lot. If you want the absolute truth, I mean, if you look at the headline numbers, Sinn Féin is in the lead on 22%, Fianna Fáil on 18%, Fine Gael on 17%. So more or less, the big three, it's more or less that neighbourhood that they have been in since the election. I looked at some of the other numbers in it. One, I should say the Social Democrats are on a bit of a roll in this. They're on 11%, and they've been creeping up in polls for 6 months.
There's a trend there,
isn't
there?
There is a bit of a trend. Yeah, Labour Party just on 4%. So those are the two numbers, I suppose, amongst the smaller parties that would look out. But if you look at some of the other numbers on it and things that will be coming into political debate soon, say when the triple lock legislation comes before the Oireachtas, you know, should Ireland renounce its neutrality? 66% say no. 56% support for the loan to Ukraine. And an equally overwhelming majority, 63% of people saying that Ireland is not adequately prepared for security challenges during the EU presidency, which I suppose points towards another story in the Sunday Times today, which John Mooney is writing about worries about infrastructure attacks and so forth during the presidency.
Yeah, okay. So they when we're out of the immediate shock of war, these will be the things that will start to come back into focus here at home. I'll just give the across the board figures there. Sinn Féin is at 22%, up 2%. Fianna Fáil, no change at 18%. Fine Gael down 1% at 17%. Independents and others, no change at 11%. Social Democrats 11%, up 1%. AIM 2-6, no change. Independent Ireland 5%, down 1%. Labour Party 4%, no change. Green Party 4%, up 1%. And People Before Profit Solidarity 3%, minus 1%. Worth saying that there is a margin of error there of plus or minus 2.8%. So everything there kind of within margin of error, and the sample size in that poll was 1,308 people. Liz, what jumped out at you there?
Yeah, there was two things. So one is, you know, the headline is kind of around that defence, people's concern about keeping, about defence challenges during the EU presidency, but only 5% listed defence in one of their top two challenges. Number one, as to be expected, is housing. And it was quite striking to me, actually. I expected the papers today, you know, obviously big international news over the weekend. I expected a lot of analysis today around the change to the renter legislation, which comes into effect today. It's not in here. It's not a part of this discussion. But I think it is top of mind for hundreds of thousands of people waking up this morning with those changes coming in. So I thought that was quite striking. You know, and I think in the context of the by election now, which is on the 22nd of May, the two by elections. And the other thing that stood out to me, Holly Kearns, the
most approved of politicians.
She's at 41% up 2, Micheál Martin at 37% up 1, Mary Lou MacDonald approval rating is up 1 at 35, Simon Harris approval rating is level at 33, and Ivana Bacic is up 1 at 32%. So fairly stable across the board.
Fairly stable, but I mean, personally, I think it's heartening that, you know, a political leader can take maternity leave, take a proper maternity leave, come back and be doing well in terms of polling. And
indeed,
well
in many polls, she went up over the course of her maternity leave. OK, Alan Barrett, you are very interested in Irish football. You've been following the story of the Flares at the match at Oriel Park last weekend, and then where the real story is at, which is the political reaction to it, etc.
Yeah, well, I think if you're a football fan, the real story is actually the football dimension rather than the political side. But just to take the football bit first, this entire incident is really, really unfortunate. The League of Ireland was often the poor relation of Irish sport, but in recent years, huge improvements. Gates have gone up, standards have gone up. Streaming service, more TV games, and everything like that. So it's been a very positive few years for the League of Ireland. So to see the damage that was done to the new pitch up in Dundalk, I think anybody with an interest was very disappointed to see it. As you say, though, the story, Shane Ross is writing about it this morning, more about the minister's reaction to this, and it seemed to be it's almost like the suggestion here there's a collective punishment being meted out by Minister O'Donovan that because this one pitch was damaged, he seemed to be saying that funding would be restricted to a lot of clubs. It is kind of, Shane Ross has this great ability. He seems to be going back about 10 years where he had his own personal run in.
Yeah, but I think in fairness, Patrick O'Donovan had a recent go off Shane Ross and said he set back women's football by years.
Well,
I think this is an ongoing spat. Yeah,
issue.
But Patrick was rolled back on fairly quickly.
Well, it was the minister brought the football authorities in and requested that they come in on the Wednesday morning. They gave certain undertakings at that stage. There was a pretty stiff punishment meted out to Drogheda, and after that, I think the minister then unblocked the.
You say it there, the minister would be portraying this as a win. He waved a big stick and he got the reaction he wanted, and then was able to step back.
You could. I'm certain that is the case, that is the way that he might that he might present it. You could also, put an alternative interpretation on it, which is that he came out and said what he said. He waved, as you say, waved his big stick, and then the clubs or the football authorities did something, and he then claimed that as a victory. I guess we'll never know really which of them it was. What interested me about it was not just, I think it's characteristic of Patrick Donovan's style. He came out, he shoots first, asks questions later in a way. But when the Taoiseach said, first of all, the junior sports minister, Charlie McConnellogue, but then the Taoiseach said at a press conference with the Montenegrin president who was in town during the week, he said, he would expect, Taoiseach would expect that there wouldn't be collective punishment, and that that he would, that the funding would be restored to the League of Ireland for Astro pitches. And then the minister was very clear afterwards. He said, no, that's a decision of the minister to take. So,
In a word, Pat, how are relations between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in this government, as far as you can see?
In a word?
I'll give you a couple of sentences.
Okay, very good.
Because it's complicated.
So I think they're not brilliant at the very top, frankly. I think that lower down the political food chain, things are moving on okay. I am not sure that Simon Harris and Micheál Martin have yet established the sort of cooperation that existed to a degree previously. And partly I think that is because the dynamic at the top between Micheál Martin and Simon Harris is a different one to the sort of triangular relationship between Leo Varadkar, Eamon Ryan as he was in place for most of the last administration. And,
who seemed to be a very pragmatic person in keeping the peace and everything. Okay, and I will just say that I'm sure they might disagree with that characterisation of things, and we'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel are still here. Brenda Power, Alan Barrett, Liz Carlin and Pat Leahy. Brenda, major talking point earlier in the week was when woke met itself at the BAFTAs. You're writing about it today.
Yes, eating its own tail, basically, because what happened was hilarious, you have to say, not the incident itself, but the contortions of the left over who most deserved sympathy in this situation. What happened was, as I think most people will be aware, a Tourette sufferer shouted out the N-word. The toxic N-word while there were two black actors on stage, and the BBC did not beep it quickly enough. I think it was
They had 2 or 3 hours. They were in a truck, apparently, the guys doing the edit, and they didn't hear
it. I mean, I suppose the point I was making in the Sunday Under today is basically, you know, either you accept that this man has a disability, and so this word is uttered without any context, without any intent, without any malice. It is as offensive in those circumstances as a sneeze. So why is there such outrage from elements of the black community, particularly, say, actors like Jamie Foxx, who said, oh, no, he meant that. He meant to say that. This is Jamie Foxx, by the way, who starred in Django Unchained, in which the N-word was used 100 times. But he said, oh, no, that then it was about context. Now it isn't. And it just seems to me that the hypocrisy around that whole position is so stark here, because what it suggests is they don't actually believe an awful lot of what they're saying.
Well, I think, Liz, probably the real issue was that this guy was being celebrated so much that night, and the BAFTAs were showing that this is a really inspirational film about a guy with these unique challenges in life. And, you know, we are marking this and everything. But when they were hit with the reality of it, they didn't know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very unfortunate situation. Like, you know, I agree with Brenna. This is an illness. You know, you wouldn't...
I think most people accepted that, in fairness, didn't they?
Until they were challenged by this.
I think so. And you know, like the cruelty of Tourette's is that, you know, your brain finds exactly the words that you're not supposed to say in a particular
it's
moment.
It's not what you're thinking secretly in your head.
It's not what you're thinking. But I do find that when these cases, happen, it's these kind of like extreme sort of like edge cases of things which are very difficult to parse through, and then they end up being positioned as woke versus woke and everyone's eating itself, which I think is quite unfortunate when, you know, racism is a very real problem. People are dealing with all sorts of challenges, economic, social, political, and then we end up having these diversionary conversations. I'm not saying anyone in particular is to blame in this situation, but it would be much healthier to get back to talking about how we can
conversation. Brenda, do you think it was a diversionary conversation?
No, I don't agree, Liz. I don't think so at all. I mean, the reality was this man has an illness, and this illness manifested itself.
I agree.
And a movie had been made to celebrate him. Now, either you believe that is an illness or you don't.
Yeah.
And this seems to suggest that you know, underneath all this performative compassion, that actually a lot of people don't believe it, if it clashes with their own pieties.
Alan?
I agree with everything Brenda has said, but just to go back to the movie itself, it's a beautiful movie.
Have you seen it?
I have seen the movie.
Okay,
yeah.
You have the rest of us at a disadvantage.
It's one of those movies that you can read about a condition or whatever like that and get some theoretical understanding. But when a movie is well made and you really get a sense of the suffering that the person has endured, mm-hmm. and it goes back to his childhood, and there's horrible scenes where he's been slapped at school by a teacher because, again, when he starts having these uncontrollable outbursts. And I think it developed such a sympathy for people mm-hmm. with the condition that I think if you had seen the movie, I cannot in my life understand how you would then make the sort of criticisms that I think.
Yeah,
I didn't
see the movie. I saw the 10-minute trailer, and it begins with him being given his MBE when apparently he said, "Feck the Queen," and then he shouted, fecking parasite at Prince Charles. And
maybe
you know,
he did
nobody.
Mean those, though, Brandon. That's the only, we don't know.
Anyway, I mean, they didn't have him thrown in the tower. They just said this is his condition.
OK, Liz, for the final minute, there's another never-ending miracle called Ozempic, and Louis Copeland is having a boom time off of it.
He sure is. You know, the Ozempic was sort of one of the images that the Sunday Business Post used in their article about that we've already discussed on the Never Ending Miracle. But it really does feel like the beneficiary of this is Louis Copeland and other people who are selling suits to men and women who now have different sized bodies. And there's all sorts of projections now, like in the that airlines are going to start saving money on fuel because of the kind of weight loss. I think in the US, 12 million people are taking Ozempic. Mm-hmm. So there is these kind of big structural changes
and there
happening.
Are other GLP-1s available.
There sure are.
Yeah, Brendan, there's a great line in the Louis Copeland things we're saying.
Which is Niamh Horan in the Sunday Independent.
Saying, throw out your old suits because they're too big for you and you'll never put that weight on again. When you inevitably do, you're going to need a whole new wardrobe. From Louis Copeland.
Okay, thanks very much to my terrific panel this morning, Brenda Power, Alan Barrett, Liz Carlin and Pat Leahy. And it's now 12 noon and we will go to Susan Jackson in the newsroom.